The whole earth heaved and flared. A tremendous and magnificent column rose up into the sky. There was an ear-splitting roar, drowning all the guns, flinging the machine sideways in the repercussing air. The earth column rose higher and higher to almost 4,000 feet. These were the words that were written by the Royal Flying Corps pilot Cecil Lewis in his book Sagittarius Rising. And he wrote those words after what he saw on the 1st of July 1916, the first day of the Battle of the Somme, just outside the village, the German-held village of La Boisselle. For many months, the Royal Engineers, the tunnelling companies of the Royal Engineers, had been digging a tunnel and filling chambers that were 20 metres apart, two chambers 20 metres apart, with 60,000 pounds worth of ammonal explosives. And at 7:28 on that morning, they were blown. These explosives were blown. It created the famous Loch Nagar crater that anyone who visits the Somme today visits. This massive scar in the earth was 21 metres deep and 100 metres wide and is still there today. It was one of 19 mines that were exploded either underneath or close to the German lines that day. And there's only two left. The others have all been filled in. And one day in 1978, an Englishman called Richard Dunning decided that he would buy the Loch Nagar crater. And this podcast is all about Richard in his own words. Because last week I went and sat down with Richard for a whole morning and we discussed many things. And with the microphone on, Richard just talked. He talked about his early life and what made him buy the crater. And he also talked in the second half of the podcast about some of the veterans who he met and took to the battlefields. And it was an experience that I don't think I'm ever going to forget. All I would suggest you do is get a cup of tea, sit down and listen to this podcast, Tales from the Battlefield, with me, Terry Wenham and Richard Dunning. So today I've come down to Surrey to meet a gentleman called Richard Dunning, who is the chairman of the Friends of Loch Nagar, the Loch Nagar crater that people who visited the Western Front and the Somme in particular will know. It is blown on the 1st of July 1960. But I've come to see Richard to talk about many things, but in particular what made Richard in 1978 buy a hole in the ground, which we now know as the Loch Nagar crater. But before we go any further, I wanted to say hello to Richard and ask him to read the Loch Nagar Crater Foundation vision, which they've recently put together. So over to you, Richard, fire away.
Okay, thank you. This vision, we've just put it on a board and we took it over this Tuesday, we're now Friday, Tuesday, Wednesday, an overnight trip, to take it over there because, in a way, it sums up everything that the crater is about. And also, young people, particularly for the first time, when they step on the site. And so if you can just bear with me a couple of minutes while we just read through it, because it's where Loch Nagar has evolved over the years of where it is up to, because it's just been finished. So it's in French, English and German. And it says, once the bloodiest square mile on the Western Front, the Loch Nagar crater is now a hallowed place dedicated to peace, remembrance and reconciliation. Loch Nagar is a remembrance site unlike any other. It's a private memorial, a sacred ground that remains to this day a unique and special cemetery. It welcomes all visitors, is free to enter, and no personal financial gain will ever be made from it. It focuses on six key areas: conservation, commemoration, education, peace, remembrance and reconciliation. Said to be the largest crater ever made by man in anger, Loch Nagar crater is a profound wound of the Great War, a powerful and poignant symbol of the suffering and trauma passed down through generations. All those who fought in that war reached striving for peace, yet over a century later we still have a turbulent and divided world riven with conflict. We believe that to truly remember and honour them all, we each have to become peacemakers, channeling our compassion and passion into healing action. We can't bring peace between nations, but we can bring peace into our own lives and into the lives of those around us. Therefore, we invite all who share this mission to join with us in saying the Lutnagar Promise for Peace, in remembrance of all those who've suffered in conflict and those who are suffering still. May we live our lives today with more compassion and kindness, understanding and forgiveness, reconciliation and unity. Let us now, in their honour, wage peace. And we just finish with the line, we thank you for visiting Lutnagar and bringing your own reflections and memories to this hallowed, haunting and uniquely peaceful place.
I think they're very strong and profound words to start our chat with, Richard. And it really reminds me, as you were reading it then, something that you've always said to me in the last few years since I've known you, is that you're a man of peace, and the crater is all about remembrance and peace. And one of my strongest memories of going to the crater over the last few years was probably about 10 years ago now. I was stood there one Sunday afternoon talking to a small group of people about the crater and what it meant. And out the corner of my eye, I saw a tall gentleman standing there listening to what I was saying, but he didn't say anything at all. And whilst I was talking, I was explaining that this is the last place that so many Germans that fell on the 1st of July, not necessarily in the explosion, but in the fighting that took place afterwards. And this man listened carefully to what I was saying, but as I say, he didn't say anything. And then we got back in our car and we followed him down the road. He was in the car in front. And then I noticed on the back of his car, it had got a D. He'd come from Germany. He was a German man. Mm. And therefore, it made me feel satisfied, I suppose, is the word, that a German man had been listening to me talking about the German dead that fell at the crater. Mm. And you can't fail to understand that because of the memorials. And now we've got this new board there and people that go there. It's not necessarily about the fighting. It's not necessarily about the battle. It is about remembering those of all nations, I think you've said in the past, haven't you, that fall in every war. So it is it's an incredible feature. So let's go back then in time to the 1970s then, Richard. And what was your interest in the Great War? I think you've got some relatives that fought and died in the Great War, haven't you?
I've got some, but I don't know anything about them. They didn't die. I had two grandfathers and a great uncle. But to be honest, the story is writ, but I mean, it's funny. I was a working class kid, arguably still am. Hadn't been anywhere, done anything, from a very rough part of London, and got offered a little bit of money and decided to go across the States. Hadn't been anywhere, as I say. Went across, and on the way back.
1971, is it?
This is, yes. Yeah. Yes. Arrived in Chicago during a riot, 2 o'clock in the morning, and someone tried to mug me, someone tried to steal my bag, and slightly traumatised because I was also very tired as well, having travelled on Greyhound buses for 3 weeks. But went into a corner, out of my bag, I brought one book, which I'd not greatly read before, called The Old Front Line by John Masefield, opened it randomly and read a few lines about the crater. Something happened, which took me 25 years to work out what it was. So that was, I think, Friday night, Saturday night, New York, Sunday to London, Monday morning in my old knackered Hillman Imp, set off for the crater. No maps. All I knew it was near a place called Owlbear, and drove across, got lost, drove up a lane, climbed a small hill, what I thought to see if I could see the Golden Virgin at Owlbear.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was at the crater, 4,000 miles in 3 days.
Yeah.
So in a peculiar, and I often say, you know, well, when did you get the crater? Well, the crater got me, because from that moment, never thinking that I would ever be able to own it, I visited it sort of every, I don't know, 3-4 weeks or whatever, sometimes going overnight, always on my own.
Yeah.
So that was my introduction with it, you know. Buying it didn't, it took another 7 years.
It didn't occur to you at the time.
Never did, because although the YSAP, the sister mine, was going to be filled in 74.
And was the YSAP, when you went on that first visit, presumably the YSAP crater on the other side of the road was still there?
It was there.
And how did that compare to the Loch Na Garr crater? Because I've never seen it.
It was 40,000 pounds, Loch Na Garr 60,000. So it was two-thirds of the size.
Mm.
But it wasn't... the thing that we talk a bit later, the why Loch Na Garr is so big is because it was experimentally over-tamped so that it would empty itself. And it was a lot bigger than YSAP. YSAP was in the garden of the chap who eventually bought the crater from, he and his family.
Right.
But we can talk about that a bit later. But I wanted to buy 6 square feet of the Somme. Yeah. So I started writing to all the notaries and the mayors, Artin. No replies at all.
No.
So this went on for a year or two or three.
You didn't feel like giving up then at that stage?
If anything, I had a motto at the time, which was, what would the Queen do in anything? Because it's not, she doesn't have all these aggravations. So I went to her solicitors.
You're not the sort of man's going to take no for an answer, are you, over something like
that? Well, I mean, there's a fine line between passion and obsession.
Yeah.
Most of the people are going to be reading this. I have an obsession, which we all dress up as a passion. But there was something about, I wanted just to own something to stand. And also the fact, obviously, wherever you stand on the Somme, probably within a few feet, there's going to be, you know, someone there under the ground. The letters from the Queen's solicitors had a huge letter and a simple premise that if the French thought I was rich as well as mad, it might just sort of uncover nothing at all. So eventually, and I wasn't going to give up, but I couldn't see where this was.
Mm.
At the time, nobody was buying anywhere in France. Mm. It was the time of the exchange controls and things. Now I don't believe in luck or indeed coincidences. I'm an old Anglican Quaker, so we have our own strange views on life. But the day that the farmer and his son went into the notary in Albert and said, we wish permission to fill this crater in, they'd filled in YSAP, took a week with bulldozers and lorries, and they wanted that. The notary said, hold on, one of the first letters, how it got to arrive on his desk at that day, I've no idea, but he said, hold on, obviously it all worked.
It went from there.
Because
they knew, presumably then they knew, the locals knew, that you'd been writing these letters, and when the farmer actually then applied for permission to fill it in, someone said, hang on a minute, someone's got an interest in this.
The notary was the one who put, the farmer's son eventually became my best friend in France, and still is, and I saw him a couple of days ago. Yeah. I'm not sure they did know, because the luck of the letter landing and their application on the same morning, it all worked out, I mean, in the sense that the price was fair. I've never told anyone the price. No one will ever know the price. Everyone is long gone, and it isn't important.
But you've always said that, haven't you? Because I know when we first spoke, you said that no end of journalists that have interviewed much did you pay for it? And school children asked that question. Yeah. And you've always given the same answer, haven't you, that it's not important.
It isn't important. And sometimes kids ask, and it's a sign of our times, really, that... Mm. I remember one group from a school said, they all came up and I was cutting something on my hands and knees or whatever, and they came up and said, excuse me, you the owner? Yeah. How much did you pay for this? I said, it's not important. I said, I don't tell anyone. They said, yeah, but we need to know. It's one of our questions. And I said, fed up, they all went away. They came back. And they said, we want to know how much you paid for this.
We weren't going to give up, then.
It's It's how we've taught them. It's not their fault. It's our thing.
Right. Price of everything is the value of it.
They went away. They came up and third time and said, look, what did we? And I just said, there was a boy there and a girl at front who were the thing. And I said to them, how old are you? And they said, 15. And I said, do you realise that under where you're standing, there's young men who died coming across this piece of land? I said, if you want to know how much it costs, ask them. Mm-hmm. I said to the girl, have you got a brother? She said, yeah, he's 18. I said, there's an 18-year-old lying near where you're standing. Ask him what it costs.
That's the price, isn't it? That's the value of the price.
And they all went quiet. Mm. Interesting enough, they went away, the whistle blew and they got on their coach. The boy came back and said, he said, I'm sorry. He said, I didn't understand.
Wow.
He said, they don't tell us these things.
No.
Now, having said that, there's brilliant teachers.
Yeah.
But this particular one, he said, we're not told. But he said, thank you. And I got his name and I wrote to him for several years.
Did you?
And a lovely boy, absolutely great kid. And we exchanged letters and things and he went and he did his O-levels, his A-level, went to university.
Yeah.
But they didn't know. No. And in a way, two things happen at that place at Loch Nagar. One is it brings people together in a way that, of course, other places, but there's something about it, which again we can talk a bit later. And also it brings home the sheer physical size of the crater, and it brings home the real violence of war, that thing. So, you know, and just to finish this little bit, is that when the Bank of England heard about it, they blocked the purchase.
Really?
Because no one had bought anywhere like it ever. And the most awful word that the civil service want to hear is precedent.
They don't like things like that.
They don't want anything. They only want new things, provided they've happened before.
Yeah, and signed off by lots of
people. And they blocked it for 18 months.
Wow.
I got lawyers and I think we got round it. And then they slapped a 50% surcharge on the price as a last-ditch effort to try
to stop you from doing it.
Yeah.
But that didn't put you off either.
No, fortunately. I mean, I'd had a business.
But
it doesn't matter. I mean, I would have, one way or another, sold the car or anything at all. But got the deeds on the 1st of July 1978.
So that must have been quite a day. The 1st of July 1978, so... that is 60, what's my mask on? 64 years, is it?
No,
62 years. 1978, 62 years, isn't it?
What, since?
Since the mine was crater
was
blown.
Oh, see, yeah.
62 years after the crater was blown, on that very day.
Yeah.
So you're there, collecting the deeds, you're at the crater, and who have you got with you that day?
I went over with John Giles, who was... went on to found the Western Front Association. John and I had been friends for several years, and he had been enormously helpful in terms of advice and things. And we went over and got the deeds. So there were two of us there.
Just two of you
for that. And then the next year there were four. Two people came. Next year there were eight, and the ceremony, if you like, the anniversary thing, and then it doubled and doubled each year and culminated, I think, in 2016 with 4,000 people.
Wow.
Yeah, all of whom had got up at 4 o'clock in the morning to be there.
Mm.
And, so all credit to them, because I think it's... But anyway, these things happen when they're meant to happen.
Mm,
and
that's right.
But it did take quite a while.
So in 1989, the Friends of Loch Nagar has been founded, hasn't it? How did that come about then, Richard?
What happened was that in the meantime, 1980, John Giles founded the Western Front Association, and a few of us who were in it at the beginning, my number, I'm proud to say, is 0002.
Yeah.
And I was vice chairman, but also veteran affairs officer, which then gave me... Now, just to go back, is that when I bought the actual on 1978, the BBC and the radio news always used to end the news with a little... They had a tradition that's that they would end the 8 o'clock news with a little piece, basically said, you think your life is in ruins here. Look what this poor wretch has got himself in. They'd always end it with a little sort of quirky thing of someone's there, and they ended it with this thing of this man has bought this
oh, really? Hole, yeah. On that day.
And I was lifting my young son out of his cot, and it came on, and I thought, the Daily Telegraph next day wrote a piece which was actually very, very good. It was accurate and it was emotive. And that 10 days later, I think probably best part of 600 letters arrived.
Really? Yeah, this is all before the internet then. So these are actual letters that come through your letterbox.
And lots from old boys.
Lots of veterans.
Yeah, yeah. And a lot of people who subsequently became friends.
Yeah.
In fact, many people became. But I got in touch with pretty well all the old boys, and we used to take them over.
Yeah.
And one of the greatest privileges in that time, in the early 80s, was standing at the crater. The one thing they virtually all had in common was that they hadn't spoken about their time there.
No.
The families were not, oh, good grief, granddad's off again.
Yeah.
Those men... With Veteran Affairs Office, I was able to write to them and as well and say, look, and I was involved in the Surrey group branch. Yeah. We set up all the branches. The members of the WFA in those early years, absolutely brilliant. Not saying they're not now, no. I don't know them. But then they were people who'd all single-handedly had this passion. So when they realised there was others, we had some wonderful times.
I can imagine.
We would organise lifts for all the old boys to come to the meetings. We would record them. We would listen to their stories. But what it did do with those is that virtually all of them had become inured to the fact that no one was interested.
That's what they thought.
That is what... And to a degree, it was true, because now Martin Middlebrook wrote the wonderful book, First Day on the Somme,
which is
triggered a lot of people's interest.
That, I read that, and so many people read that and thought, right, I've got to know more about it.
Indeed. And then a bit later, Lynn McDonald came on and others and interviewed them and wrote their thing. But in those early 2, 3, 4 years, they were all in their 80s, I think they had braced themselves that they would go to their graves with no one caring.
Really?
And it's a generalisation, but in my experience, it was true. The modesty of those men, you know, why do you want to talk to me? Well, I didn't do anything. You know, well, what did you know? One particular chap, Norman Skelton, lovely, such a sweet man on there. He lived near me and we used to take him to the Surrey meetings, and his thing was, I didn't do anything. I didn't do anything. So what was your war then? Norman, my job was to, I had a radio listening post at the foot of the Buchan Wallencore, and he said, we used to listen, and he said, every morning, he said, I had to go and get water for the batteries, and he said, a German sniper used to shoot the heels off of my boots as I zigzagged to get the water.
And he didn't think that was an extraordinary situation. He thought that was
didn't
normal.
Think he'd played any part at all in the war. And he, shortly after that, he was blown up and deafened and invalided out. But
and he thought no one would be interested in that story.
He had no concept that anybody would be interested. And there were pretty well all of them. But they, when they realised that there was a little audience who wanted to hear, it was amazing. To go over there, and I went over there, Tom Easton and Roy Beeling and several others, standing at the crater, particularly, so I remember with Roy Beeling, who lost his best friend in the crater, Alfred Moxon.
And he was there on that day with his mate.
They were there, but they he was a Six Wilt, so they went in on the second of there with the Cheshires. But nevertheless, Roy was standing I stood with Roy on the lip, and he told me about his best friend, Alfred Moxon, and Alfred Moxon's brother. They were on the other side, because the peculiar thing, nobody had been told about the size of the crater,
no,
or the fact that it was hot.
It was smoking.
It was full of smoking, yeah, but with seriously poisonous gases in it. So men were throwing themselves in it. And Roy did that, slid to one, got up the other side. Alfred Moxon got to the lip, and Roy and Alf's brother were saying, come on, come on, come on. A German machine gun was traversing backwards and forwards.
From the lip?
On the lip. Alfred, from behind, but could see him, and cut him down because he froze on the lip. Now, it's an interesting story that he was not put on the Tietbau Memorial because of an administrative slip-up. But very, very rare did that happen. And in the late 80s, a Canadian journalist wrote and said, have you seen, there's a printed in Canada, a little book with a diary entry of a soldier who went down the crater and said, I'm standing at the small cross, and on the name is Moxon.
Moxon
is buried in the crater.
So he's still there?
Yeah.
He's in the crater?
He's in the crater, and we've laid a wreath for him ever since.
Yeah.
And interestingly enough, William Aupin, the artist, who did a tour of the battlefield and did two excellent paintings of the crater, he describes going down and seeing a cross there, and there's a skull by the side of it. Now, this is the picture that is used on the Michelin guides.
Yes, I've seen that. Yeah, it's quite a harrowing photo, isn't it?
Now, William Aupin, I think what had happened, he'd been around the battlefields for weeks, months or whatever, he kicked the skull. He kicked the skull and something happened, and I think he had a nervous breakdown and he was taken, and I don't think he painted for quite a long time.
Because of what he saw?
I think the accumulation of what he saw.
And the emotions.
But the skull was by the cross, and the cross is, I think Moxon is down there, you know. But he represents all of them, you know, in a way, the unknown, the unsung. And ever since, we've always tried to, I've always had a thing which has upset a lot of people over the years, is that the only VIPs were the veterans.
Yeah, of course.
Then when they went, the veterans' families.
Yeah,
if you came, you know, my granddad was here, then lay a wreath. Everybody who has come and said we would like to, that the crater belongs to everybody.
Yeah.
The ceremony, we don't have them and us. We have, whether there are there, I mean, up till COVID, there were up to, say, 4,000 people.
Yeah.
We end with hands around the crater.
Yeah.
And that in itself produces stories of people. But it's a funny one. So go back to the early 80s then, to WFA, with me bringing the old boys over. And we got to know Harry Fellows, Tom Easton, and stories of those. I mean,
so the one you just mentioned was Norman Skelton.
Skelton
saw his mate die on the 2nd of July.
It's Roy Beeling.
Roy Beeling, right. Tom Easton was one that was there.
Yeah.
And we've got some descriptions, eyewitness accounts from him. And Harry Fellows, he's the chap that's, his ashes are buried in
Mehmet's Wood.
When he died in his 90s.
Yeah. In a little thing with Tom Easton used to come over and...
So I've heard so much about Tom, as I said to you before we started recording. I've read his words, I've seen the board at the crater, but this is our chance, my chance and everybody else's chance to find out more. What was that man like?
Mm. He was a remarkable, absolutely. He was down the pit 42 years. I think his father was 52 years. What he told me, because he used to stay with a friend of mine in Albert. But so picked Tommy up, and another really good friend called George Harwood, who older people will remember on their travels, as he was lived in Newcastle. Brilliant, lovely, lovely man. The three of us would take Tommy round, and Tommy would talk about his stories. One of the things I remember him on, we used to have a dinner at the Delapay Hotel, which I stayed. Next year, it will be my 50th year of staying there. But the Delapay was the headquarters of the 34th Division Officers Club.
This is in Albert?
In Albert, yeah. And the last president, when he was dying, John Stafford Wood, appointed me the president. So I'm proudly now the president of the 34th Division Officers Club. But we would have dinner then we would go for a walk up to Baycourt Cemetery. Mm. When Tommy was in the line, his brother was there, was a sergeant, I think. They joined up with about half a dozen from Pitt Village, and I think it was Ashington, I think, outside Newcastle. And they were in the trench. His brother went off doing duties and told Tommy to go run an errand, which Tommy did. A shell landed right in the group of his best friends.
And he'd gone.
Killed them all.
He'd gone to take a message.
He was around the corner.
And this is at Baycourt, which is, for people that don't know, it's just behind the bridge, where the British lines
this
were.
This was, the second line trenches, because the first line was where Loch Na Garr, the tunnel was started, Loch Na Garr Street. There was a second line, and behind it was Baycourt Wood, which was, as you can imagine, an activity. Baycourt Chateau was in it, so they did use it. Tommy took his friends, his comrades, down to Baycourt Wood, and they were buried there. Each year, when we would see Tommy, we'd get him, George would bring him over, and I'd meet them over there. After the meal on July the 1st, we would walk the 2-3 miles, 4 miles possibly, it's a long way up to, and we would let Tommy, George and I would stand at the cross, the memorial at the top of the cemetery, and Tom would go down with his lighter. He would walk up and down the graves, updating them with the news of their families.
Oh,
and
that's unbelievable.
So pitch darkness.
How many of them were there, did you say? How many of those lads?
There'd be about half a dozen.
Half a dozen there in all,
but I
cemetery.
Think there were four that I think two of them were brothers.
But I have to go and see these. When I go in a couple of weeks, I shall go and see these lads.
But he would walk around and he would just talk, and there would be tears going down there. But he would tell them about what news of their families.
And for you standing there watching him and listening to him do that,
it became a thing. We did it. But interesting, now we do the same. We have a pilgrimage of up to a dozen, 15 of us, every July the 1st. Obviously, the last couple have been fractured. Yeah. But we walk up there, and in Tommy's memory and in of them all, we have poetry readings and some music and things, but that was started with Tommy.
Yeah.
And these are priceless memories, such gifts and things, but that was the thing of when you talk to the old boys, every one of them had extraordinary stories.
Yeah.
They were subsequently recorded for books and things.
Yeah.
But when they were saying that virtually for the first time, in the belief that no one was interested in what happened to me, and that gave them a sort of a closure
in their
life.
And
a lot of them became far more sort of relaxed about. Some of them were bitter, and some not unkindly bitter, but they were hurt.
Of course,
they'd all seen things, they'd had to do things that nobody had acknowledged. And when they came back, as we know, the 20s and things, you know.
It was a struggle, wasn't it, for them?
But, you know, the world wanted to put the memories. I mean, what is amazing, there were hardly any biographies written until 1929 about the war. 10 years.
10 years afterwards,
10 years afterwards.
Yeah.
So for 10 years, And a common theme with we're talking to them or their families was that the men would come home from work, they would have their tea, but they would go into their garden, into their allotment. They couldn't talk about what happened to them, you know. Then the following generation didn't ask them.
And well, then, the Second World War came along.
And then the Second World War won, and I mean, they invariably did their bit.
Yeah. I think that explains, you've just broken a thought, a memory in my childhood, because my grandfather was in the Royal Garrison Artillery, he served all 4 years, at various times. And my memories of him as a child, he lived in Swindon, he lived in a bungalow, and his back garden was the most beautiful garden I've ever seen, even to this day. I don't know anything about gardening, but I can remember all these beautiful roses, and I can remember a bench at the bottom of the garden and my granddad just sitting there, not talking to us, just sitting there. And I think that reflects what you've just said about these guys that you knew. What on earth was going through his mind? We'll never know.
A lot of it was recorded, and the Second War ones, I think, were possibly acknowledged and valued during the war with films and books and things.
Yeah.
But that, the 1418 lot, went for the bulk of their lives without believing that anybody... Yeah.
Because they didn't talk to their wives or their families about it, really, did they?
It's a funny one. I got to travel to meet lots of them, and just a couple of them. One of them was an old boy up in Bedford, and it was in the last newsletter, so forgive me if you probably read this anyway. But
I might have done, but people listening to the podcast might not.
No. So every Saturday I used to go off and try and see them. And one old boy went up there, he was very ill. He was a little cottage in, outside Bedford. Lovely old boy. Went in, the room was in darkness, his bed was downstairs, which is always a bad sign, and he had cancer, and he was very frail. Lovely handshake, both hands or whatever. His wife then said, I'll leave you two to it, I'm going to the shops. So she did a cup of tea and we talked. And he talked to when he went off to war, he'd never seen a boat. He'd never seen the sea. He went across and talked about his action, but I mean, it was, you know, with this sort of modest, oh, we didn't do much, all of this stuff was. But what he did say was that I said, I want you to do me a favour. He said, I want you to go upstairs in the top of my wardrobe. He said, in the far corner is a box. In that is another box. Bring it down. So, are you sure? Yeah, I can bring it down. He opened it, and in it were two roses made of ostrich feathers.
Oh,
beautiful thing. I've still got them, still treasure them. He said, on his 18th birthday, his friends took him to a nightclub in Arras, down the stairs. He said, and he was a church boy, so he went in, packed with soldiers.
Yeah,
barely see across the
room. All the cigarette smoke and everything.
Yeah. Pipes and things. They had arranged for him, for the cabaret singer, when she came out in her sort of exotic gown and things, they sat him down in an alcove. She came over, sat on his knee and sung Happy Birthday to him. Can you imagine the effect?
At 18.
18. So there he is at sort of 88 or something, all those years later. Yeah,
remembering.
And he said, his wife started to come back. She was in there, and he said, take these flowers. I said, no, they've got to go to the family. I've got no family.
He wanted you to have them.
He said, take these. And I said, there must be, no, take them. So the wife came in, and he slammed the box shut, and a bag by the side, put it in the bag, you know, and the wife came in, and rightly so, said, look, you know, he's getting very tired. I said, it's okay.
Yeah,
I said, I'm trying to go. So I said my goodbyes, literally, because then, with these old boys, they were all like granddads, you know.
Yeah.
So I had about a dozen granddads die and some of them I cried my eyes out.
Yeah, because you got to know them so well.
Fred Dixon, who lived across there.
Yeah.
The stories that they had, they were wonderful, but that quality of humility and modesty, you know, is that. And anyway, I said goodbye to this old boy. The wife said, I'll see you out, went to the gate, and with a twinkle in her eye, she said, he gave you something, didn't he?
Oh, she didn't know.
And I said, I'm not saying. And she said, he gave you those bloody flowers, didn't he? So he thought I never knew about those. He's had them all these years.
Really?
I knew, yeah. But she was laughing.
And yeah, yeah. She,
it
yeah.
was not an itch. But it was, and I've got them now.
And it meant so much to him. And he understood.
They summed up that so many things. One was his coming of age, if you
yeah,
like.
I
you
see.
Know, as a young man, he'd never been any done. But also, I think that what those little staminets, you know, basement represented was a sort of an oasis out of their lives.
Like Poppering.
Poppering, exactly right.
And Albert, typical places.
Yeah. That it had such symbolic thing, and also the thing of the sauciness of this girl took these two roses from her bodice and gave them to him.
That's what you want when you're 18, isn't
tons
it?
Of ribald comments and that. But a tiny inconsequential piece of memory, but, you know, I shared it with you, and that's good. But they all had their stories, you know. And, I mean, one particular boy who was an officer, senior officer.
Because it's not about the fighting, is it? You're not talking about the fighting. You're talking about
but
them and how
but
they live.
These are lives and these are stories, you know, that can get slightly...
Yeah.
This old boy was a major or something, tall man, and still sort of in the late 80s. Now, he, when I said about how did you deal with when you came back to the war, he said, oh, I didn't have any of that. Not. He said, people make a fuss. He said, I just got on with life. It didn't have any effect on me at all.
Really?
And his wife said, and she was in the corner, sort of armchair knitting, and she said, but darling, every morning you wake up, you're under the bed.
Oh.
And he said, everybody does that.
He thought that was normal.
He chose to if you like,
bravado.
Rationalise his...
Bravado, isn't
but
it?
Every one of them had stories. If those stories get locked in, if you know, with that trauma and get buried, that they get passed on.
Mm.
And the number of times, one of the great things about the creation, I was there a couple of days ago, as I said, you can talk to people, I don't say who, you know, not to do with owning it, but you just say to someone, if you say to someone, did you have family here?
Mm.
But that, so many times over the years, people have said to me, oh, I said to you know, granddad came back, or sometimes in the early years, my dad came back. Of course, he never cuddled me. He would never cuddle me. I, you know, he never cuddled my mum. He never held her, whatever. And I said, well, did you talk to him? And they'd never say. But the daughter rationalised it by saying, of course, he lost all his friends. He lost his brother. He never got close to anybody ever again
because he was frightened
because
of
the pain of losing.
Mm.
And the tragedy of the 1st of July, as we know, is not only the fact that all of that conscript sort of generation of Edwardians rose out of the trenches, but the fact that they were all Powers battalions.
Mm.
So when you have a line, you know, the German machine gun mowed down a dozen men.
Yeah.
They were a dozen tragedies to a dozen families, but also the street, the community was devastated.
But Accrington was such a small town, wasn't it?
But everywhere, and all those, the 34th Division particularly, I mean, more men died at, I think, 75% of casualties at the crater. The stories of, you know, and we have a panel at the Information Labyrinth panel at the crater, which is a story of a John Scollin, who the night before the battle, July the 1st, he believed he was not going to survive. He wrote this letter, which we print down there, and his grandson reads it out often at the ceremonies, July the 1st. He had six kids, and he knew he wasn't come back.
Oh.
And he sent her back a little, I think it was a little cross made out of a bullet or something, which... grandson has got. I mean, you can't imagine, and that family lost their husband, their father.
Six children.
The wife then went on to marry, and I don't think very well, but to give the children security. And the ripples of that July the 1st, 7:30.
Well, it's happening now. The ripples are still,
they're still going on.
Still going on now, will forever.
Yeah. And why people, this is where it gets personal to me, and I don't expect anyone else necessarily to buy. People go to the crater because it's a physical wound of that war, and arguably of all wars, because when you talk to, read about things with people in Vietnam, the veterans, Afghanistan, any veteran, anyone at the sharp end who experiences this, they are never the same again, despite what they say. So going to places like battlefields, and obviously there's lots of places, everyone has their favourite places, the crater, the physical size of that wound, and to realise that, £1 billion worth of chalk went a mile up into the sky, the violence of it. But in a way, it does speak to them. And people, I think it is a place of where people are healed from there, because families carry these wounds, the Germans. And only a matter of a few months ago, tiny little story, I bought in 1980 from a bric-a-brac shop in Cornwall a German battlefield cross.
Oh, really?
Which I'd had, took with me through moves and everything.
Yeah.
And had it in the room. And when it was last autumn or whatever, thought, I tried to get it back, but I then spoke to a good friend who is an ace at research. And I said, let's
find out about the man.
He did it through Volksbund, the German war graves?
Yeah, the equivalent of our Commonwealth.
Within 3 days, he had the name of the grandson. So, with my friend's help, we sent it to the grandson.
He sent the cross?
The cross. Wonderful family, absolutely there. And it's now in a museum close to there in Baden-Baden.
Yeah.
Lovely
people. Lovely little place.
Klaus Latulé.
Yeah, tourist area.
And sweet, such a good... It's brought their family together with photographs
and stories.
That's that friendship
piece we were talking about. And that particular soldier, where is he buried? Is he in Fricourt?
He is in Fricourt. I think he was killed.
Fricourt, for people that don't know, when we go to the Somme, we obviously visit the Commonwealth War Graves Commission cemeteries, but we also go to Fricourt, where most of the Germans that do have a grave on the Somme are buried, and there's a mass grave. I'm trying to think how many.
It is. I think he's
somewhere
up in Langemarck.
Oh, is he?
Yeah.
In Belgium?
Yeah, but don't quote me, because my mind's just gone a bit blank.
No,
he was buried on the battlefield. It was then blown up, which is where the cross appeared. And he was reburied, and then he was taken to under the big
concentration.
And I think I should know, because I've got the story upstairs.
That's incredible.
But it just... You just show how all of these little bits and pieces, you've got the little roses, the feather roses, and the cross or whatever, that everyone has those stories and trying to pull them all together, But you, Terry, will carry on this thing. I mean, going to have to hand over before too long. Fair enough. I've had a good shot. But... the stories of the humanity of the men, and whether they're German or French, it doesn't matter.
No.
Because everybody who went into that, as we say, anybody who suffered in conflict, it's happening now.
Yeah.
I think
that's what's made for me, this podcast over the last few weeks has made it even more emotional, because as we're talking about these things, it's happening. You turn on the TV and it's happening. I've always said to people, when we're out on the battlefields, about your feelings, this is history. Mm. But now it's not history, because it's happening now.
No.
You know, and people will be talking about this war in 100 years' time. Mm. Incredible. So we first met 5 or 6 years ago. We were firing Lee Enfield rifles, weren't we, at Bisley, which was a fantastic experience. And You told me then that there's been, over the years when you've been at the crater, you've heard all sorts of myths told at the crater. Can you tell me one or two of those myths? There's one about you live in a castle in Northumberland, don't you?
The main one, which is very irritating, but it's just bizarre, is that people have said, three or four years ago, I was sitting with some friends at the crater, and a man walked past, and he said, "You're all mugs. You're all mugs," he said.
He didn't know who you were?
No. And he said, he's never been over here once. He sits up there in his bloody castle in Northumberland. He's a multimillionaire, and you mugs do all of his work. You make me sick. And walked off.
You didn't tell him, did you?
No, I didn't. No.
You just let him go.
And that's a comment. Now, where on earth that comes from?
But there is a man, I think, called Richard Dunning, who lives in a castle in Northumberland, isn't
Well,
there?
No, there's a man called Richard. I think there are 12 Richard Dunnings, bizarrely, and one was left back for Reading Football Club or something. But I think somewhere along the line has conflated the story of the man who invented the cat's eyes.
Right.
Because he bought a giant man.
Oh, right.
And he sits.
But was he called Richard Dunning?
No,
he wasn't.
No, see, but there's no. There's a. I was up, three years ago now, and by golly, if you stand there and you listen to some of the things, but one of the things was a tour guide said, "Oh yes," he said, "I'm a good friend of Richard Dunning."
He said, right.
Yes, he said, "Yes, he was the son of my teacher at Hinckley College." Yes, he said, and you don't want to say anything because he's got his kids there.
No.
It'll give him a
hard time.
But
yeah,
people fill in gaps.
Yeah, they do.
Fill in gaps.
Yeah.
And
what they call Duff history, isn't it?
Well, you know, and the crater, who owns the crater? I've been there not that long ago, just before COVID, and someone said, "Oh, the Wargraves own it, you know, or whatever."
But it's not difficult to find out the truth, is it?
How can people not? Because all you've got to do is tap one word in internet, isn't it?
Yeah. So we're now coming to the end of the, hopefully, the COVID crisis. And the crater, like us, has suffered during this period, hasn't it? With the, it must have been 10 or 15 years ago now, you built the path around it, which made it much more accessible. But that's crumbled in a way, isn't it?
It's starting where it's been up 11 years on there.
It was 11 years ago, wasn't it?
Yeah. We had a thing of anybody. Now, obviously, it's open all the time and it's free and all of that. But how do we get wheelchairs, people with wheelchairs up there and round? Chalk, as you know, before, when it's wet, walking around was it. How anybody didn't break anything. But so we've put the walkway. One of the problems, because it is so exposed up there at the wind and rain or whatever.
It's always windy there.
The supports have rotted. We were over there last week, this week, to work out the plan to replace all the slats themselves aren't too bad. They carry the plaques of the names on there.
Yep.
And they're not too bad. It's the underside where it's in contact with the earth.
Yeah,
and
that's where it's rotted.
We're
going to
replace it all with steel. And
oh, really?
We're over there speaking.
So you're going to have to lift the whole thing up?
The whole thing. We'll do it in sections over about 18 months.
Right. So you're not going to get it all done in that working weekend in June.
Oh, this is a major job. The WFA, it has to be said, have kindly given us a donation.
Mm. And I know there was a fundraising campaign
and
as
there
well.
There was a fundraising, lots and lots of good people.
Yeah.
I mean, the number of good people over the years who've been drawn to help with the crater, whether we have the working weekend at the end of May, early June, that long weekend, the crater isn't in too bad a condition considering we haven't been able to do any maintenance for at least 2 years now. But what happens when it grows, it's now coming into April, May, the stuff down there that is thicker will turn into small trees. And that it took 10 years. I got it in 78. It was 88, 90 before I could say it was under control.
Right.
And that's going
over
once a month.
And you're doing that yourself friends. Then, before you had the foundation.
With the friends. With friends started. Mm. So there, when the when the Friends of Lutnagar was formalised, you know, obviously we managed to get into groups to go over there regularly, but by golly, nature has a way of there. And
we can see that when you look at photos from 1919 or even 1917, that the Somme nature has taken over the trenches and the battlefields again. And we just touched on it there. I was thinking how people can help. Obviously, go and see the crater, people going out to the battlefields again. We mentioned on the path there are memorial plaques to soldiers, not necessarily soldiers that died, but soldiers that served. Mm. And there's one there for my great uncle. And people can buy these plaques, can't they? Is it £25?
£25. Anybody who was in the war, men, women, we're quite keen that women and nurses and volunteers on that are commemorated on there. So, yes, it is a way of basically not only commemorating, not just commemorating the men and women, but also supporting the crater itself.
And it's fascinating because when you walk round the path, you know, there's hundreds of these plaques there now. Mm. And, of course, they've all got a story to tell.
Every single one.
People can find out more about that by going to www.lotnagarcrater.org. And there's lots more information. Do you know, Richard, it's time for lunch, isn't it, now? And we've been talking for nearly an hour. And I don't feel like we've even scratched the surface of some of these stories. So I think in a few months' time, with your permission, we'll have to sit down and talk through some more,
because anytime,
this is it, you know, this is oral history, and you're a witness to these guys, you know, that a lot of other people haven't got. And it'd be fascinating to find out more about these soldiers. You had a list of names.
We barely
touched it, have we? And I'll take a photo in a minute. You're sitting there with that book by John Mansfield, the Old Front Line. The book.
That's the very book that I took over, and the description of the crater.
It looks well thumbed, doesn't it?
We've no time. It was reprinted, actually.
Yes, I've got the reprint at home.
But a little gem. But by golly, you know what, that page of reading that.
Look what it's led to. And I think my final comment on this, obviously, to thank you very, very much for your time today, I did a school trip in 2019, and it was a private school from Northamptonshire, and one of the girls, they were 13, 14, she was crying. And obviously, I didn't like to ask her why she was crying, but I subsequently found out later on, one of her friends told the teacher that back home in Northamptonshire, her father owns a wedding venue and is obviously very well off. And she has a very good lifestyle with horses and everything else. And she said that when I was telling the stories and reading the quotes and the people that were there, she suddenly realised it was because of their sacrifice that she was living the life that she'd got now.
Mm.
And she was completely overcome.
Mm.
And that's without having the crater and all your efforts, she wouldn't have taken that thought back, and hopefully she'll...
But also without people like you to tell her what happened there, isn't it? I mean, that's the link, isn't it?
Yeah.
And she will hopefully carry that
and tell her children one day.
That's
what we're trying to do, isn't it? That's the whole point of this. So thank you very much, and let's go and have some lunch, shall we?
You are very welcome, Terry.
And that was it. I think, as we realised when we were talking, that we'd only scratched the surface, as Richard said, and there are so many more stories to be told about the Lotnagar crater and the surrounding area, that in a few months' time we'll sit down again and we'll record some more of Richard's thoughts, his memories, and also some of the stories from the men that fought there. So just as a reminder, the Lotnagar crater, the aim of it is to preserve the site and create and maintain the unique Garden of Remembrance to commemorate the gallant men and women of all nations who suffered in the Great War. And it is in their memory that this podcast is dedicated. And as a reminder that these men and women will never, ever be forgotten, so long as we keep talking about them and visiting places like the Lotnagar crater. Thank you.